This is actually one of my favorite parts of the meeting, when we actually get to honor those who have advanced our understanding of autism. And we have some special awards today, and it's a, sort of a jam-packed award ceremony, so we're going to go ahead and get started. We're going to start off by inviting Sally Rogers to come up and talk about some of our student awards. So, Sally?
Thank you, David. I'm delighted to announce the awards for Dissertation Young Investigator Awards. For those of you who are getting these, find me afterwards in the reception, and I will have your award for you. Maybe you could stand in place. So first dissertation award is presented to Lee Cepeda. Lee, would you stand up, please, if you're here? There you are. For her work on examining the social deficit in autism. Lee's study was called A Comprehensive Study of Facial Fixation Behavior Through Development from UCLA. The second dissertation award is to Mike Lombardo. You hear Mike? Don't see Mike. His work was on cognitive and neural mechanisms underlying self-referential and social cognition in autism from the University of Cambridge. Young Investigator Award, the first is to Sophie Lind. Are you here, Sophie? There's Sophie. Congratulations. Thank you for your wonderful paper on episodic memory and episodic future thinking in adults with autism. And the final Young Investigator Award is to Delilah Pinto. Are you here, Delilah? There she is. For her very nice work on functional impact of global rare copy number variation in autism spectrum disorders. Let's have a hand for these incredible young people. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Sally. Go to the next slide. So last year we started a new grant program, which was called the Slifka-Ritvo Innovative Research Award. We presented two awards last year, and the Slifka Foundation has agreed to continue that program. So there was a call for nominations, and we had a panel review the nominations. And this year, we would like to have the president of the Slifka Foundation, Dr. Ariella Ritvo, tell us who won this year and tell us a little bit about the science that are going to be awarded. So, Ariella?
Hello. Good afternoon. This is a little bit of a mixed blessing. I'm here on behalf of the Alan B. Slifka Foundation to present the award for innovative research in ASD. And I just wish my husband could have been here with me to present this award as planned. However, my husband passed away in February, so I would like to present the awards in memoriam to my husband, Alan Slifka, who in 2002 decided that ASD was an incredible thing to get into, and we added it to the mission statement and the goals of our foundation. And then Alan, a man of great vision, tried to figure out how do we give awards without getting so many grants that we can't process them and we need personnel and whatnot. So together we tried to think of creative opportunities, and we wanted to do pilot grants for studies or ongoing studies that might lead to NIH grants later on, especially creative studies and harder to fund studies. And where do you go but MFAR? And so we went to NSAR and talked to David, who was very receptive to the idea of beginning this program, and we decided to create two awards, one for excellence in innovative research in basic science and the other for clinical work. So the first award for innovative research in basic science is presented to Dr. Dan, and forgive me with your last name again, Ron Schweig, is that good enough? And Dr. Judy Van de Water. I believe a lot of you were at their presentation this morning, and their study is the childhood behavioral correlates of maternal antibody status in autism, and they're a part of the UC Davis group. And the Slivka-Ritva Award specifically will support experiments which will determine the direct effect of maternal antibodies towards antigens 37, 39, and 73 in vitro, and hopefully ultimately in vivo. And you might ask, why do we want to fund this? Findings might include identification of fetal brain proteins playing important role in brain development, and creation of a test for the presence of the antibody, and most significantly, potential of reducing the risk of having an autistic child through techniques such as plasmapheresis. So I hope all of you read the abstract if you did not go to their meeting this morning. And so on. Without further ado, I'd like to present the award to Drs. Van de Worden and Dr. Brunswick. Congratulations. The second award for clinical research is equally well deserved, and this year our D is Dr. Alicia Hall for her study using telepsychiatry to increase early identification and screening in pediatric practice. And we do believe that telemedicine is going to redefine the standard of care of creating many opportunities for outreach. And this is a pilot study in South Carolina by South Carolina Autism Treatment Network, which consists of the University of South Carolina School of Medicine and Greenville Hospital. And a telemedicine model was formed to provide educational and expert consultation to assist pediatrician in screening and referrals of ASD diagnosis. The issue of difference in access to educational services is addressed, and the grant will fund and aim to bridge the clinical gaps discussed through a systems-based educational process. So they're going to have a multidisciplinary conferences, and the deliverable will be a consensus document. I had the chance to speak to Alicia just a little while ago, and much of South Carolina is so rural, and services just don't get there. So this will be a wonderful way of delivery of services, and we wish her a lot of luck in this study and look forward to hearing more about the results. So without further ado, Dr. Alicia Hall, will you please come up to get the award? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Ritva. So I think it's fair to say that if it weren't for parent advocates and other stakeholders, most of us, or many of us, in the room wouldn't be here. Certainly, IMPAR wouldn't be here. And the board of directors this year decided that it was about time that we acknowledge some of the advocates who have really made a difference. And we will have a series of advocate awards every year from now on. And if I can just go to the next slide. It's interesting. I wrote a preface to a book recently, and I wanted to have some sense of how autism research has expanded over the last 50 years. And so what I did was I looked at how many times the Connor paper defining autism was referenced since 1945. And it turns out that between 1945 and 1954, autism was such a rare disorder and such a sort of a backwater that his seminal paper was only referenced 34 times. But as you can see, over the years, the number of scientific citations of Connor's paper has increased dramatically. This is really unusual for science. Usually papers sort of peak and sort of go down. And it's really a testimony to the fact that autism is certainly a much more important topic for research and in our culture. And There's a couple of interesting areas where things have sort of taken off. And one was after this period here when our first honoree, Dr. Bernie Rimlin, wrote his seminal book in 1964. And then what you can see is there was again another sort of burst of activity in the mid-1990s when two major parent advocacy groups were formed and encouraged research. And so we would like to honor tonight Dr. Rimlin and the founders of those advocacy groups. First, we'll start with a presentation in honor of Dr. Bernard Rimlin. And I'm going to invite to the podium Dr. Stephen Adelson, the successor as the director of the Autism Research Institute, to give this remembrance of Dr. Rimlin.
Thank you, David. This is a very exciting moment for the Autism Research Institute, which is located here in sunny San Diego. And as you will see in a tribute video that will play in a few minutes, Dr. Rimlin was a true pioneer in the field, and he dedicated nearly 50 years of his life to understanding and treating autism. Now, before the internet, Dr. Rimlin was a one-man World Wide Web. He was constantly communicating with researchers, parents, and doctors. If he heard of a possibly brilliant idea that could provide insight into autism, he made it a point to share that information with others. And whenever he read a significant research study, he would contact the researcher, thank them personally for their efforts, and then he'd often share his own thoughts and ideas on the subject. Now, those who remember him, Dr. Rimlin took pride in being straightforward and telling it as it is. And you'll also see that in the video, I'm sure. Now, I know that Dr. Rimlin would have wanted me to mention that he was always frustrated with the slow progress of research and that he felt that we need more federal and private funding to help figure out ways to help people who are alive today. In addition, he would never lose sight of developing a standard quality of care for everyone on the autism spectrum. Now, Dr. Rimlin always felt that families and those on the spectrum deserved the very best, and he truly cared about them from the bottom of his heart. And I'm positive that he would have appreciated this honor. And here with us this late afternoon, we have two of Dr. Rimlin's inspirations, his wife, Gloria Rimlin, and his son, Mark Rimlin. Could you stand up, please? And you'll hear more about them in the video, you'll see. Okay, well, why don't we show the video, because I know we're somewhat limited on time, so why don't you...
Dr. Bernard Rimlin was born in Cleveland, Ohio, and spent most of his childhood and teenage years in San Diego, California. He earned undergraduate and graduate degrees in experimental psychology, not knowing at the time that his career choice would change the field of psychology and the lives of thousands of families. In 1953, after completing his PhD at Penn State University, Dr. Rimlin returned to San Diego, where he began a career as a civilian researcher at the Naval Personnel Research and Development Center. He and his wife, Gloria, soon started their family, which included three children, Mark, Helen, and Paul. Their first child, Mark, was born in 1956. He screamed and cried from the moment he woke up until the moment he fell asleep. During his first years of life, he exhibited all of the classical symptoms of autism, including lack of affection, inappropriate speech, insistence on sameness, and inappropriate play. Mark's behavior was of great concern to Dr. Rimlin and his wife Gloria. They consulted with numerous doctors, and none of them had any idea of what was the matter with their son.
My wife remembered reading one of her old college textbooks about a child something like this. We went out to the garage, found that book, opened it to the chapter on abnormal conditions of childhood, and there for the first time, and this was 5 years beyond a PhD in psychology, I saw the word autism.
In 1964, Bernard Rimlin, whose wife had given birth to a child who turned out to be autistic, published a really breakthrough book called Infantile Autism.
To me, the world is a big puzzle for an experimental psychologist. So when autism hit our family, I put that skill into the service of this cause.
Very good, isn't it?
It sure is.
I was appalled to find that everything I read pointed to the mother as the cause of the problem. They would give cases of a mother that they said was hostile. But of course, I kind of wondered, was that mother hostile before they blamed her or after?
In my book on autism, I tried to articulate as carefully as possible each of the arguments for psychological causation and each of the arguments for biological causation. And I came to the conclusion that it's extremely unlikely that the psychological environment, mother's treatment of the child, for example, has any particular bearing.
When Russell was first diagnosed, we looked for help, and Dr. Rimlin was one of the first people that we went to find out about autism. This man is an icon. He is a hero. He is the personification of all that's good in a parent.
Dr. Rimlin wrote the landmark book for his firstborn son, Mark, who's now 47.
Ice cappuccino and...
Maybe everybody should get one, right?
Yes.
Yeah, we'll do that.
Mark was one of several autistic adults Dustin Hoffman studied for his role in the 1988 film Rain Man. Dr. Rimlin was chief consultant on the movie.
We were told when he was 5 years old he was a hopeless case and institutionalized him. He was not toilet trained until he was about 7 or 7 and a half. Did not ask a meaningful question or answer a question until he was about 8 and a half years old. He was being taken on a school bus to another town, and he turned to my wife and said, "Will you be here when I get back?" And she almost fainted.
Infuriated by the accepted theory that mothers were to blame, Rimlin started the Autism Research Institute in San Diego when Mark was still a child. It became his life's work.
This was war.
Yes. No question. It still is.
Long before computers or copy machines were commonplace, Rimlin gathered information from all over the world, evaluating research, arranging conferences.
I hope, well, 1,400 people, but I'm very disappointed to see you all here today. And they kind of look at me kind of funny. And I said, in my ideal world, we'd have a conference on autism and no one would come because there's no more autism. But we're not there yet.
I must have heard daddy or mother talking, saying that Mark's autistic when I was younger, and I don't remember which it was. So I asked my mother if I'm autistic, and my mother told me that I'm only a little bit autistic, and that I was very autistic when I was a boy.
And now, you're artistic.
Yes.
It's a different word, isn't it?
Yes.
In 1967, Dr. Rimlin helped produce an award-winning documentary called The Invisible Wall, a film often shown at colleges and universities throughout the country. In this documentary, Dr. Rimlin theorized that autism may be a result of an interaction between genetics and the environment, which is today the accepted view by many researchers in the field.
I think that, like any other genetic disorder, there's always an environmental factor that relates to the disorder, or usually an environmental factor.
In 1965, Dr. Rimlin founded the Autism Society of America, which was originally called the National Society for Autistic Children. The National Autism Society was initially created to disseminate information regarding behavior modification, or ABA. When Dr. Rimlin would travel around the country for the Navy, he would contact parents in the community and encourage them to form their own local autism chapter. The families and the professionals thank you, Dr. Rimlin, for your hard work, dedication, and perseverance. And yes, the children thank you too.
So in honor of Dr. Rimlin's life and work, I'd like to present the INSAR Special Recognition Award to Gloria and to Mark. Thanks, Steve. As I said, in the mid-1990s, autism research really took off. And again, I know personally that I wouldn't have been in the field if it wouldn't have been for parent advocates seeking out scientists who were doing other things, trying to get them interested in doing autism research. And I think the parent advocates in this field have had a huge influence on what has been done over the last decade or so and what will be done in the future. So we would like to honor two couples who were enormously influential in the course of autism history. Portia Iverson and John Shestack, who were the co-founders of Cure Autism Now, and Karen London and Eric London, who were the co-founders of the National Alliance for Autism Research. Beyond starting those very influential advocacy and funding organizations, both Portia, John, Karen, and Eric were influential in starting this meeting in 2001 when we were getting this together. It was really the impetus from CAN and NAR, with a little help from mine, that really launched this whole effort. So again, in order to acknowledge their major contribution to autism research, we have initiated the INSAR Advocate Award, and we'd like to honor all four of these influential people with the INSAR Advocate Award. And we'd like to ask them to come up one after the other and give us at least a brief sense of their feelings, maybe about this award, about the field. So I'd like to start and invite Portia Iverson to come up and give us her thoughts. Portia?
Well, it's an honor to be here, and I must say that Bernie Rimland was a hard act to follow then, and he still is now. That's just so amazing what he did. When our son Dove was diagnosed with autism, Dove's now 19, so this was about 16 or 17 years ago, at the age of 21 months old, the first person we ever saw doing anything that looked like research that had to do with a biological cause to autism was Bernie Rimland and his newsletter that was published. And it was interesting listening to Stephen talk about how Bernie interacted with scientists, how he would find these articles. He was the human World Wide Web, you said. I think that's a great expression. And would call them up and talk to them. And it's not that different today, in a way, even though we do have the World Wide Web. And really, that's going to be kind of the focus of what I want to talk about up here. Just a second.
Is there any chance to switch these so I can see it better?
Okay. Thank you. Oh, thanks. Okay. I'm not going to show you slides, don't worry. I wasn't able to print this out. But so I was thinking today about, I'll back up a little bit. I was just at an NIMH meeting where Tom Insel asked me, what do you think parents are feeling? What's the state of the public these days? How are they feeling about research? And I said, I think there's a generation of parents right now that were the advocates for the last 10 to 15 years who are feeling frustrated. And they're feeling frustrated and excited at the same time. And I think that if I had to say there was one thing today that we should continue to do and do even more is what Bernie Rimland said or did, which is it's extremely important to keep bringing people with autism, especially, children and people of all ages, into the proximity of scientists and researchers. I think this is one of the most important things because this urgency that is autism, the challenges that face people with autism and their families are of such an urgent nature, and no matter how much money we get into the field and how many of the best scientists we get in, which we have, I feel, and it's absolutely thrilling, if anybody for a minute or a day forgets why they're doing their work, why they were funded, what they're supposed to be doing, if you go to any lecture here and at some point you say, well, how is this actually going to help, and the researcher isn't telling you, then they've gotten a little bit off track. And to me, all the funds and all the advocacy and all the brilliant minds in the world still need to be in the proximity of what it is we're talking about, what it is we're trying to help, and that is we're trying to help people with autism have a better life. We're trying to help families cope. We're trying to find out the causes of autism. We're trying to find out treatments and cures for autism. We're trying to find out ways to give a meaningful education to people at all levels with autism. So I just want to quickly say that my view of autism took a radical shift around 2008 when I went to a Keystone Symposium meeting. And there was kind of like good news and bad news. It took me about 4 months to absorb what I saw there. So I'll just give you an example of some of the things. One of the things I heard was Jonathan Sabat talking about copy number variation. So for 10 years with our gene bank, we'd been looking, you know, for polymorphisms, just a different model of genetics in autism. And now there was this other thing that was starting to look like, and subsequently other studies look like, wow, there may be an awful lot of kinds of autism, a real lot of kinds. And at first this was kind of very disturbing and upsetting because, well, if there's 100 kinds, even if there's a few main groups, like how are we ever going to get through this and figure it out? And then we heard from Art Baudet, who told us about, epigenetic effects and gene methylation and how genes can kind of change on the fly. And now these days we have, what are they, transposons or something? So we keep getting more and more information, and it keeps looking like there are more and more types of autism. So the other half of what I saw at this Keystone meeting was a series of researchers working in the very things that we excluded from our gene bank. We said, oh, these aren't really autism, like Fragile X, Rett syndrome, tuber sclerosis. These were people who were working on treatments for these little slivers of the pie that we said weren't autism. By the time I left the meeting, I had the idea that maybe there were an awful lot of these slivers and we shouldn't throw those little slivers out because maybe everything was kind of like one of these. And what was really eye-opening was that these other disorders that had far less funding and were operating on a smaller level were at least 10 years ahead of us in terms of having things in the pipeline. So I'll just give you a quick example. I saw Alcinio Silva talking about a drug called rapamycin for treating tuber sclerosis, and he just this year published an article about using it in the treatment of autism as well. Tuber sclerosis, you know, another developmental disorder that all our lives we've been told these things happen gradually over time and they're not reversible, and suddenly there's a pharmacology at a cellular level and then starts to be at an animal models level that we see is able to right some of the problems of a developmental disorder. It's very radical. We never thought that was possible. So Louise Parada was there also using the same drug. He was using it on a P10 knockout mouse, which was considered an interesting model of autism. And again, suppresses anatomical, cellular, and behavioral abnormalities in these mice. Mark Baer, probably everyone's heard of, and developed the glutamate antagonist, the mGluR5 compound that is now like in the pipeline on the way to market. So, you know, all of this I'm telling you because we have to back up a minute and say, you know, we have gene banks, we have genes, we have a lot of basic science. And then as we begin to shave off these sections of the overall disorder of idiopathic autism and name them, once we know a molecular mechanism and we know a lot about these compounds, the third part of the picture that I saw at that meeting was Takao Hench, who studies brain plasticity in adults, humans and animal models, and at a cellular level. And like Mike Mersnick, who many of you have heard about, there are people, you know, studying brain plasticity and using both pharmacological and behavioral ways of retraining the brain in, you know, at a cellular level or molecular level, in animal models, and in adult humans. And all of these things are coming down the pipeline towards us. So I think if I had to say how are things going to Tom, that would be my long answer, is in one way they're going great, and in another way it's very overwhelming. But all the pieces and parts are coming into focus. And I think that now is a time when we, you know, advocates need to be around. They need to keep saying, you know, you must come spend an hour with my autistic child. You must come to my home. You must see what autism really is. You must understand it. And every minute and every hour and every day, if you're going to take an autism grant and work on something, and all the more so if you're a genius, remember why you're doing it. I'm going to just close by saying, you know, the urgency and the time factor and the suffering for people with autism and their families, we have to keep these in the forefront of our work and in the forefront of our thoughts as advocates, but also the researchers. And relevance has to drive priority. And I just want to close by saying, you know, I have really started to shift my focus since CAN merged with Autism Speaks to looking at the what I call the forgotten half of the spectrum, which is the nonverbal people with autism, whom we know almost nothing about, and just say that, you know, okay, we had 10 years where we had to get autism research going, and we said they were too hard to work with. We used to say women were too hard to work with, minorities were too hard to work with, ethnic groups were too hard to work with. Well, I say that, you know, we have to embrace this part of the group, and who knows, we might, you know, we might find amazing things there. But the important thing is that in this day and age, with all the science and research that's gone on, how can we have, you know, be somewhere between 20 and 50% of the population who can't communicate, and there are no grants about how to help these people communicate better? I mean, there are behavioral and speech and language-related grants, but there's nothing specifically about people who are nonverbal coming through at the NIH or to private foundations much. So that's kind of like a huge last frontier that we need to address. But I want to thank you all for honoring us today, and it's fantastic to see this meeting grown the way it has and turn into such a high-quality, large gathering of, you know, just dynamic people, and with people like David and Dan Geshwin helping us. Thank you.
Thank you, Portia. Our next recipient is Karen London, who I'd also like to invite to come up and give us a few words. So, Karen?
Thank you. It's an honor to be here on the occasion of IMFAR's 10th conference, and I appreciate INSAR's recognition of the National Alliance for Autism Research and the efforts over a period of 12 years, the efforts of its remarkable trustees, donors, and volunteers. I would be remiss if I didn't recognize a few of those people who are here today. Trustee and generous donor Debbie Hillebrand, supporters par excellence Greg and Lori Ireland, Dr. Manny DiCicco-Bloom, who led our incredible scientific advisory board meetings and was a guiding light for our scientific advisory committee, my dear friends Dr. Susan Hyman, who helped us form the most superlative scientific advisory board when we didn't even have letterhead, and Dr. Ami Klin, and tonight's honoree, Dr. Margaret Bauman, both of whom encouraged Eric and me to make what was for us the life-altering decision to establish NAR. Actually, Margaret, you didn't really encourage us to form NAR so much as to push us off the ledge to do so. Eric and I had dinner with Margaret one spring in 1994 and asked her if she knew of a nonprofit to which we could donate money. or whether we should consider starting one. And she said, boy, that's going to be an awful lot of work, but it would be a wonderful thing to do. And we said, well, all right, if it's going to be that much work, maybe we'll just have to think about this a little bit more. And the next day at the conference, someone, and I was not a plant, said, Dr. Bauman, what more can parents do to help advance the research in autism? And she said, where's that couple I had dinner with last night? They just started an autism research organization. And Eric turned to me and I said, and whispered, I think we just passed the point of no return. And NAR was born. That was the beginning of what was a wonderful journey. And when this morning I listened to Nicole Gage talk about language in nonverbal children and saw this week's New York Times article about the Korean prevalence study, of course, brought back a lot of wonderful memories for me. The Korean study was actually one of our final 62 grants that we awarded in 2005. And all in all, we funded 270 grants for just under $30 million all over the world. And to many scientists, we gave pre- and postdoctoral fellowships who are now mentors and advisors themselves and doing incredible work. It was really the families, as Portia and John will attest, and what we call our partners in research, who answered the call to both fund research and to participate in research. But in the end, as you all know so well, we're still only at the beginning of our efforts to understand the etiology and effective treatments of autism. So when my daughter, who was but 4 years old when NAR was started, and who is now 21 and about to graduate college, turns to me and says, Mom, do I have a higher chance of having my own child with autism? My heart breaks. So I continue NAR's work to support autism research, now as co-founder with Allison Singer of the Autism Science Foundation. And I beseech each of you to continue your work with a sense of urgency. And on behalf of our son, Zachary, and for countless other children who, as Portia says, don't have a voice of their own to thank you, I'm thanking you for your work. And I pray that there'll be transformative breakthroughs that we will be celebrating at this conference in the not-too-distant future. Thank you.
Thanks, Karen. So our next recipient is the other founder of Cure Autism Now, John Chestak. John, would you please come up?
So thanks for having me. I guess by giving us this award, where'd it go? It's like saying IMFAR is finally old enough to open up its own wax museum, and that's kind of how I feel. It's amazing to see people I've known a long time here, and really a long time, and people who sat around, you know, tables with and had drinks with and argued with and flew on red eyes to Washington with and had tremendous triumphs with, and it's great to see old friends here, but it's better, really, to see lots of young new people who I don't know. And that's much more actually exciting. It is nice that people are thanking advocates, because a lot of times people don't. People say, you guys, you can't ever get along. It's a shame the advocacy community doesn't all say the same thing. You know, some say, it's genetics, some say environment, some say vaccine, some don't, some say inclusion, some say special education. It's like, we're allowed to have our disagreements because all of our kids are different. If they're 3 or 30 or 4 or 40, they're different, they need something different. But I do, to toot the horn of the advocate and understand what the advocate does, just give you perspective on if there were no advocates in autism, there'd be no brain bank that you work with. There'd be no gene bank. There'd be no policy on sharing biological materials at the NIH. There would be no ACE centers. There'd be no START centers. No one would have lots of those big walk T-shirts that make such excellent pajamas. if there were no advocates, we all would still believe that autism affects 2 in 10,000 children. That's what it said in some textbooks that you may have read when you were coming up. We might still believe that psychoanalysis was a cure, and 95% of us would have some other job. And that's because parents, primarily parents of autistic kids, took time out of their like freaked out, hair on fire, heartbreaking day to raise money and affect policy. And that is going to continue to, that's going to continue to happen. We will continue to be supportive like that. You know, the thing is, we do live in an age, I've said it before, I'll say now, we live in an age of miracles and wonders. Like, you know, we have video chats like they used to have on Dick Tracy. Remember that watch? He would say, like, I'm on my way, and it was like, we have that. You know, you have, used to, you know, ENIAC would take up an entire room, and now you can fit like twice of the processing power in your pocket on a little drive. My grandmother's pacemaker was the size of a hockey puck, and my dad has one that's the size of a silver dollar. So that is progress. But if you ask me, are things really much better for people with autism from 20 years ago, when there were maybe only, you know, 12 or 15 scientists really working full-time in autism and $5 million a year being spent? Honestly, I would have to say not really. The thing is, if you are if you're a person who's under five who has autism and you have parents who make over $200,000 a year, things are much better for you. There is no doubt about it. You know about early intervention. You have access to early intervention. You will get it, and you will probably make a lot of progress. Not everybody, but a lot of people. But if you are over 8 or 18 and your parents are poor, you are out of luck. Nothing is better for you than it used to be, except maybe you won't get beat up as much on the playground. You could probably go to the supermarket with your folks without like creating a riot. You could probably find a dentist, which is a big progress. But basically, things have not changed enough. And, you know, I'm really sorry that, like, that Dove is 19 and we don't have a treatment and a cure for him yet. I really thought we would. I thought we would be further. But do I feel silly to have given, like, 10 years of my life to a group that at the time was called Cure Autism Now? I don't. I still think that it's a good idea, and I think that it's more possible than it ever was before. I think we'll do it. I think you guys will do it. You have more access to information than you've ever had. You have better tools than you've ever had. You have more colleagues than you've ever had. And I think you have the tools to get it done. You know, I wish I knew how to use my computer, though. That would be the only thing. Then I could really, I know how to read. It's hard to believe when you're around here, but when we started and when Karen and Eric started, scientists had to be persuaded and wooed and recruited one by one to get into autism. There just wasn't anybody doing it. They had to be explained to that this is the most amazing thing, this is the most interesting thing, this is an area where you can make a difference and you can now suddenly make a living. Every dollar raised seemed to come from our own bake sales and our own brownies. And every grant that was funded was argued passionately over. And in fact, there was a moment I remember, somebody put in a grant for this kind of very inexpensive, portable EEG machine we thought they were going to have. And we thought, like, could this be good? It sounds crazy. Maybe it isn't. God, it would revolutionize the way care could be delivered if it was really true. And one of the scientists on our scientific advisory board said, all right, I'll go down and check it out. And like 3 days later, I ran into him in the meeting, and he had like this giant red welt on his forehead, and he had really checked it out. And, you know, it's like they say at like political breakfast, they go like, you know, at bacon egg breakfast, they say like the chicken was involved, but the pig was committed. Well, Ted at that time was committed, and he did He just, like, he tried it on and flicked the switch and he did what he had to do. And I think that's the only thing I ask for you guys, to be that committed. Like Portia said, if you don't know somebody, actually know somebody with autism, and it's possible that you don't really know some kids with autism or families raising kids with autism, get to know them. Get to know exactly who you're working for and why you're doing it. Don't let it be abstract. Let it be personal. When you learn something new, like it was so exciting when I was walking down the halls eavesdropping on the people with their posters and they were like exchanging emails and information. And when you learn something new, give it away. Give it to the next person. Competition is like overrated. It just hasn't gotten us where collaboration is going to get us. The meeting this morning on nonverbal kids, somebody said that they discovered that repetitive behaviors interfere with learning. Right. That is often true. So I would say if you know that you're writing the fifth face recognition grant, don't write that grant. Write something else. Don't try and be incremental. Try and, like, make a quantum leap. We'll be really happy. The final chapter in autism research has not been written. But you guys should write it really fast. Write it. Close the book. We'll all come to the signing party. It will be fantastic. And we will be here to support you until you get it done. Thank you.
John. Thanks a lot, John. And so our fourth recipient of the NSAR Advocate Award is Eric London, co-founder of NAR. And Eric, come on up.
Well, it's actually great to be the last of this group. On the other hand, everything I wanted to say was kind of sad, but I don't want to give up my time, so... The first thing I really want to comment on is the size of this meeting. This is really fantastic. I was trying to go through the abstracts last night, and I was just going on and on and on. It wasn't ever going to end. For those of us who've been here from the beginning, this was a small meeting at the beginning. So the field has grown tremendously, and there's a tremendous energy here. There's a lot of young people, which I think was already said, but I just want to reiterate that to any young people in the audience. I'm so old I can't see them out there. It's obviously the young people that are going to drive the field. And I think it's worth saying that right now in 2011, we're in a kind of crummy economic time. And I really do understand how that impacts people, especially people who have to survive on grants. What I do want to say is that this stuff is cyclic, and I'm old enough to remember bad times and good times and bad times and good times. So if you're out there listening to me and you really want to make a career out of autism, go for it. You're, as has already been said, you know, you're the guys who are going to write the last chapter. I also want to talk about this in a historical perspective. When I heard I was getting this award, I started thinking about it, and the whole thing seems kind of surrealistic. It just kind of happened. And I was trying to figure out how it happened. I mean, how did we go from a couple hundred to many thousands of people here? So I started reading some history books of developmental disabilities. And there's some Egyptian writings that go back, I think, 1000 BC, that talked about developmental disabilities. They didn't use that word, obviously, but they described developmental disability. And they actually said this is an illness like other illnesses. Obviously, over the past 3,000 years, that has not been necessarily the norm in people's thinking. And so what happened somehow, maybe it happened in the 1960s, maybe it happened in the 1990s, I'm not sure. But what happened is somehow, as opposed to all the other developmental disabilities, autism seemed to open up the concept that this is a disease and it could be diagnosed and treated and possibly cured. And that's really novel. And so, yes, there are diseases like Fragile X that are probably way ahead of us right now, but that's just because they have the gene. The fact of the matter is that we've created this enormous research infrastructure, and we do have some of the best scientists, and so we're really ready to flow with this. So if you could think of yourself as being part of history, I think that's accurate. This has never been done before in the developmental disabilities over thousands of years. Back in the 90s, before we were raising much money, we got a call from two parents in Pittsburgh, and they said, we'd like to do a walk. And we didn't know anything about walks. You know, March of Dimes did walks. I didn't know anything else about walk. And so we called some people we knew, and we were referred to a guy who makes his living as a walk consultant to different companies, and we said, okay, we'll pay you and go help these mothers in Pittsburgh. And then, you know, we were kind of out of it. Karen and I had virtually nothing else to do with it. You know, we had an occasional phone call, how's it going? But we really, we had nothing to offer. But anyhow, we were going to go to this walk, and we were driving from New Jersey to Pittsburgh, and I have to say that we drove in probably the worst conditions I've ever driven in. It was tremendous rain, lightning. I literally couldn't see the highway. It was the scariest I've ever been driving. And we pulled off, got a hotel room somewhere in Pennsylvania, got to Pittsburgh next morning, still raining, not as hard, but, and we were just devastated. Like, we're going to drive all the way to Pittsburgh through this, and no one's going to be there, and it's raining, and it's mud, and the whole thing. Well, there were 3,000 people who showed up that day, and we raised about $200,000. And we had nothing to do with it. I mean, the only thing we had to do with it was that we made one good decision, and that decision was hiring the walk consultant. And so I really think that, I mean, the lesson is it's very good to be on the right side of history. It's very good to tap into the forces, the higher powers that are driving this thing. Sometimes, though, you have to make one good decision. And so just with that in mind, I'd like to challenge the group. Two things I'm going to mention. I don't mean to be presumptuous, but two things I'd like to. I really don't think we know what autism is. And that may sound kind of unusual at the INFAR meetings, but I really just don't think we know what autism is. There's a lot of really good scientists have been writing that there's autisms and that there's so many etiologies and the phenotype is so varied. And so we're using the word autism, and I think we're using the word autism in a self-deceptive way. We're correlating a lot of things to this entity that I don't think we could define it. We could be reliable and define it, but it's not valid. We really don't know what we're talking about. And that's really scary, and that's probably the thing that scares me most about the history of where we've been. I really think that it's time now to take a more creative approach. And that may mean dropping the word autism or using the word autism in different ways or creating more sophisticated ways of looking at the phenomenon that we're seeing. But I really think that's a huge challenge that we're going to have to meet. Otherwise, I think we're really bogged down. And in that vein, I'm going to make one more specific appeal. One way that we're going to find out about autism is not really by animal modeling, because frankly, the animals have to model after some human disease. Now, I'm not against animal models, and in NAR we funded lots of animal models, but we're going to find out about autism through work with humans. And probably the main place that that's not being done is in the world of autism tissue. I've been working for the last 15 years to try to promote successful programs to get autism tissue. And I have to say that I'm really frightened that this is going to amount to a large failure. One way that we're going to find out what autism is to study the autism tissue. The NIH is contributing almost nothing to autism tissue research. We're probably being outspent, the tissue world is probably being outspent 1,000 to 1 in terms of genetics. That makes no sense to me. Genetics is great, but we're going to learn about the genes, the gene expression, the epigenetics, the environmental role only through the use of tissue. We're going to be able to learn about this on a cellular level. Scanning is great, but it doesn't have the resolution that we can get with tissue. And so I would like to deputize everybody here. Please make a pitch that it's not expensive, but can we get the NIH to give a little bit of money so that we can do some real tissue work, which I think will clarify the situation greatly. Thank you.